I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
You're listening to Achtung the Wall, broadcasting from the beautiful South Birmingham. Accept no substitute.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the world-famous Achtung Millwall. We are big in Borneo, and we are back. My name is Aaron Paul. Delighted to be with you once again. In fact, not quite delighted. I'm sort of just bullshitting that one a bit. You know, the whole Project Big Picture thing has got me a bit wound up with football right now. And at this moment in time, I'm just tossing up whether I'm going to be going to Combined Counties League or Isthmian Division when my club decides to shithouse itself to more sort of like printing money, like levels of domination. Anyway, joining me this week, the podfather himself, Mr. Nick Hart. He's nearly approaching bus pass age, I think. Is it bus pass age yet, Nick? Or
No, you don't get your bus pass till you're 67, Aaron. You get all sorts of weird medical calls at the age of 60. Yeah. I can tell you that much, but we won't dwell on that because this is a family show.
Let's just put it on. He's expecting the rubber glove any day soon. Yeah, but that bastard Sadiq Khan, if Sadiq Khan's listening, sort it out, get him his bus pass. Get it to him now. Stop being tight and get rid of this ULEZ as well, you bastard. Anyway, carrying on as well, we've got a new signing. I mean, this is kind of like, you know the EFL window is obviously open to the 16th. We've decided to strengthen the ranks here. I'm not sure what kind of a contract Nick's got him on, but he's got him in through the door. We've got sports journalist and public health specialist Oscar Omar with us. Oscar, welcome. Willkommen. You had a trial during the summer and you liked it, and so you've come back.
Yeah, I can't say that I'm getting paid much, but I appreciate the welcome, and clearly I did something right in the trial. So yeah, glad
getting
to be
paid.
The pay is terrible on this show, listeners.
Hey, I get a shilling a day and a whole shit sandwich. You know, like, you know, Nick's slave driver, mate. I don't know what you're on about, pal. Full blown slave driver. Gentlemen, we've come together this evening, not really to talk. Well, we're going to be talking about Millwall a little bit later, but obviously the big thing that's been dominating the headlines over the past sort of 3 days since Sunday has been this whole Project Big Picture thing led by Manchester United and Liverpool, who amazingly despise each other apparently, but now can work with each other when it comes to printing money and sort of like Premier League domination. Yes, that's right. These two shit cunts have decided that they want to fucking sort their own little league out. This is the precursor to the Super League, by the way. This whole idea was a pure precursor to European Super League. They wanted to basically shave the Premier League down to 18 teams, have some ludicrous playoff system, and then basically, as compensation, give the EFL a one-off hit of £250 million. But when you divide it, it doesn't actually do that much for a lot of clubs, and it doesn't really safeguard the future of football. The whole thing was an absolute shit show, and I think, and I'm ashamed to say, this was my club and our biggest rivals trying to take advantage of a very, very bleak situation. It's like that cash-rich guy who walks into an auction after your house has been repossessed and he fucking scoops it up for a pittance. That's exactly what Manchester United and Liverpool were trying to do. It's an absolute disgrace. I am ashamed of my football club. I am very, very, very ashamed of my football club. But do you know what? I'm not surprised, because Manchester United are the equivalent of a football franchise. They are looking to make money at any point. Henry Winter, someone who takes a lot of shit as a journalist, picked up on a really, really good point where he talked about how he met Joel Glazer. I think he's the chairman or the vice chairman of Manchester United, and basically told him, well, he wasn't fit enough to talk to Sir Alex Ferguson, to talk to Sir Bobby Charlton, to even sort of, you know, have his presence graced by these individuals who have made football so brilliant. As a game, football is about the working class man. It's a working class man's game. We go on a Saturday, we enjoy, we come together. This isn't about money, but you know what? It's become something that is dominated by money. The Premier League has bastardized football completely, and I am fucking ashamed to say I support a club who have led this whole shambolic campaign. And I'm glad that it's been outlawed. That's right. In the past, what, 3-4 minutes, you know, the news is sort of breaking that the Premier League clubs have unanimously agreed that Project Big Picture will not be endorsed or pursued. The controversial plans proposed by Liverpool and Manchester were rejected at a meeting of the 20 clubs. Instead, all clubs have agreed to work together on a new strategic plan for the financing of English football, also deciding on a £50 million rescue package for League One and League Two clubs. Gentlemen, I've had a bit of a rant because I am fucking ashamed. I'm so, so, so ashamed of my football club. If we haven't proven what absolute scummy, like, dickheads we are, and I apologise, Nick, for the swearing, you can beep it, you can do what you want, pal, but we are scumbags. Manchester United are absolute scum. This is just proving exactly what these people are about. Making a fucking pound. Making money. That is it. They want to control this division and squeeze the very life out of it. If you look at the Football League, the Football League itself was founded on sort of democracy, if you like. It's like a mini political movement that governed a game to make it fair, to make it equal. This would be making a game not fair, not equal. Clubs wouldn't be able to break their, you know, back and try and get into the Premier League. And, you know, obviously with the spending power, they wouldn't be able to match the spending power of United, of Liverpool, of Chelsea, of Arsenal, of City when they arrived into the Premier League. They wouldn't be able to do that. They wouldn't be able to go and fight these teams properly. And then eventually you'd see a breakaway where the top two teams end up in a European Super League or something like that. And for me, that is when football dies. A horrible, horrible death. We are lucky. Today, we are very, very lucky that there are still some sane individuals in the game. And I look at someone like Denise Barrett-Baxendale, who's the chairwoman of Everton Football Club, who's demanded an apology by United and Liverpool, demanded a fucking apology and said that, you know, effectively, you're trying to bring the game into disrepute. It's an absolute disgrace how United and Liverpool have conducted themselves. These fucking scummy people from America coming over, they've bastardised their own sports. They've sold out to England. They've sold out to Daniel Levy. Yet they're trying to do it to our own game. It's an absolute embarrassment and I fucking apologise. Nick, I'm about to have a cry. You crack on.
What a great rant. I've got to say, Oscar, that's the best thing I've heard in years.
That's fantastic. I love that.
Well done, Aaron.
Five live, pay the big bucks, boy. That's five live.
I'm not sure we're even going to be the ones who are going to provide sanity to what we've just heard, but I'm going to play devil's advocate. As much as I hate what they've done, as much as I'm glad that Watford were relegated and weren't a part of what took place, there were aspects of those proposals that were interesting. I'm going to phrase it as interesting and not go so far as to say they're worth considering. But in terms of 25% of all future TV deals on top of the 250 million rescue fund, in terms of potentially a pretty epic final season playoff between the shithouses who finish 18th in the Premier League and whoever wins the championship playoffs, that could be pretty epic. I think in terms of getting rid of things that we don't really care about, like the AFL Cup, and the Community Shield being scrapped, I mean, that's got potential. And the annual revenue being upped from the Premier League to the EFL from 4% to 25%. There are things there that are worth discovering. and worth learning from, not least the improved travel attendances for away fans and a £20 cap on away tickets. I mean, it's worth chatting about.
Yeah, no, I agree, Oscar. I mean, there's Aaron's right. Aaron is right. This is the logical conclusion of the project called the Premier League, which began in 1992 as a method by which the big five then, I think that included Everton at that point and didn't include Manchester City, but the same kinds of principles underpinned that creation of this behemoth called the Premier League that has grown over the years to the point where now it sells its product in literally every corner of the globe, and it's a huge money spinning operation. And you know, the logic of that led to the creation of the Premier League was to break the very the Football League's principles, which looked after the 92 clubs as a kind of a collective, didn't allow this, didn't allow that. And was felt to be restraining on the interest then of Liverpool, Manchester United, Spurs, Arsenal. I can't remember the fifth one. I think that was Chelsea. It might have been, it might not. But anyway, that's how we got the Premier League. So
Villa.
This project big picture, I would contend. It's been knocked back. I've seen the same tweets that as we're recording this, listeners. I don't know that the ideas underpin it have gone away. I'm sure they're going to come back another day. You've mentioned the European Super League already, Aaron, and you know that's not going to go away, because I read that the Agnellis, who I think are Juventus, they like the idea of a Euro Super League, and I'm sure the Barcelonas and the Real Madrids will do too. So a lot of these proposals were to create space in the calendar, an 18-team Premier League, to allow for more fixtures elsewhere, more lucrative fixtures. And I'm going to go with a lot of what Oscar said is right. There's a lot of interesting stuff and a lot of good stuff in this proposal. Where it fails is the mafia-style hijacking of control of top-flight football into the powers of the special nine, the nine longest-serving Premier League sides, which would include, clearly, Liverpool, Manchester United, Arsenal, Chelsea, Spurs. And then the other, bizarrely, including West Ham. I mean, how they creep into this, it never ceases to amaze me. But It's that, it's the hijacking of the game and what that would lead to further down the line. That's the sticking point. And they're not going to concede this amount of money, they being the kind of mafia-style trio at the top of this little scheme. They're not going to concede anything big without getting something big in return. It's Trump-style football here. You don't give anything without getting a lot back. And they're going to get complete control under this scheme. I see that the Premier League have rejected it. I wouldn't have expected them to do anything else, because you're asking the Brightons and the Burnleys and the others to kind of vote themselves into a reduced position, which they won't do. I can't believe this wasn't announced without this expectation in mind. So the next move in the chess game will be what happens next from the Glazers, the John Henry and the Parry trio.
Nick, sorry, John Henry and Joel Glazer didn't turn up to the meeting.
No, they don't have their stooges to do that. They don't.
Fucking embarrassing.
They don't dirty their hands with real meetings. They have people for that.
For everyone that knows me, they know I'm a staunch hater of the Glazers. I hate these people. They're fucking parasites. You know, I saw a book today. It's called The Glazer Gatekeeper by a guy called Tessin Nayani, who was their PR guy. And it actually made me smile, because he turned up to my university when I was doing sports journalism about 3, 4, 5 years ago. He turned up to my university to promote his book to a room of like 30 people, expecting everyone to sit there and basically, you know, how do I say it? You know, perform an art of fellatio.
I was going to say be a gog, but you've come up with a more picturesque analogy there, I think.
When in reality, I nearly got kicked out because I fucking nearly kicked the shit out of him. Parasitic people are destroying our club. Now, Oscar, I'm going to try and bring a bit more level-headedness to this, and I'm going to say this is why I don't like it. This is why I feel a bit iffy about it. If you look at America, the way they have franchised things and the way they work things, they can do that. because it takes, you know, you have to go on a plane to go from one side of the country to another. It makes more sense to do things like that in America. This country, I can drive from one end to the other in, what, 6 hours, 5 hours, something like that. We don't have the space for that. We don't have the capacity for that. We have built something so, so good over 100 years, 100, 130 years in football. We've built something phenomenal. Now, if you look at Americans, they're looking to develop their game. And I was a big person who sits and I sit and I look at, you know, the NFL games that take place at Wembley. And then this groundbreaking deal, which is basically finance Spurs' ground with Daniel Levy. And how, if, I don't know if anyone's watched the Tottenham documentary, he turns around in one of the episodes. It's embarrassing because I had to woo them with a stadium. You know, it took 6 months or 2 years or something like that of me, you know, dating them effectively for them to try and get into bed with us. You should be fucking embarrassed, mate. Granted, you built yourself a new ground. One, there was nothing ever wrong with White Hart Lane. Let's be fair. It was a great ground. It wasn't exactly falling down. But this insatiable greed, insatiable fucking desire to print money has seen Spurs build themselves an NFL ground. It's not just the Tottenham ground. In fact, from what I understand, they have separate dressing rooms for the NFL.
They need big facilities.
They have separate dressing rooms for the NFL. The NFL are happy to see their game come over here. You know what? Why are we trying to Americanize things? Why are we trying to build these conferences, if you like? If you look at the MLS, I don't pay any attention to it because of the pure amount of rules they have. They used to have so many with drafts and salary caps and stuff like that. We were heading that way. And surprise, surprise, it's two Americans who try and influence this and try and bring this into our game. Surprise, surprise, it's two people who have been very, very successful in another sport. Obviously, the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, well, less so, purely because the Glazers couldn't fucking organise a prayer in a mosque. Let's be fair. They're the shit-housing bastards. FSG, they've been more sensible. They've operated on Nani Ball. They've cut him. They've got the best manager in the world. They've probably got the best squad in the world right now. And you know what? As a United fan, it pays me to say this. Respect them. They've done things well. Because they've got the two biggest powerhouses in the world. And no matter how much Man City will shout and try and raise their little voice and go, we're a big club, we're a big club. They're not when it comes to Liverpool, Manchester United. They're not. Same as Chelsea. Same as Everton. These are new money clubs. These are new money clubs. You look at all these clubs who are getting foreign ownership and whatnot and people ploughing loads and loads of money into them. Yes, they've got the money. Yes, they're spending £40 million on Richarlison and money on James Rodriguez and stuff like that. But they don't have the trophies. They don't have the clout. The clout in the name, the branding to back it up. You go to America and you try and sell shirts with the name Manchester on them, I guarantee you, if you ask a straw poll, would they be red or blue? They'd probably go red. Red, 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 red. Manchester United and Liverpool, the two biggest names out there. It just so happens they're owned by Americans. They are trying to bastardize this game. Any opportunity. If you notice as well, over the past 6-7 years, there's been constant rule change after rule change after rule change after rule change in the Premier League. Every year, VAR, goal line. I remember, what, 6, 7, 8 years ago, they're talking about goal line technology. The watches. You know, I don't know if anyone remembers that being such a big thing where Hawkeye, everyone was like, well, we need goal line technology. It was after Lampard in the World Cup in South Africa. They brought that in. That actually did well. Then they were talking about VAR for 2-3 years. They brought that in. Slowly, 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 they're talking about things. Talking about a fucking sin bin. How much further can you change the variables that operate this game? Because that's what it is. That's what football's based on, variables and factors. The fact that, again, everything in life is mathematical. If I have X, what will come out of it? Well, you could have Y or Z. Well, if I go to Z, what will be the outcome? It's all about differing factors. And, you know, in terms of these packages that were offered and whatnot, it's all superficial. At the end of the day, this is a power trip. This is the two biggest clubs in the country turning around going, you know what? We've got the financial clout. Let's back ourselves with City. Let's back ourselves with Chelsea. Let's go for it. Let's try and control this league to a point where no one else will get a look in. Don't forget as well, Nick. Don't forget. This Big Six didn't exist a couple of years ago because it was a top four. And then in the 90s, it was a top two with Arsenal and United. There was no Big Four, Big Six.
It's a varying, movable face. Oscar, you wanted to come in there, mate?
Yeah, I was just going to say, the Premier League already has been bastardised. This was too late. This was just...
I agree.
the reality in writing, isn't it? I mean, they're already talking with their money. This was just giving a vote to it. The Premier League is already dictated by the powerhouses. Are we going to get a Leicester again? No. Would love to see it. And I think it's about what you watch football for. If you're watching it, I know I'm speaking to a United fan, so I'm probably preaching to the choir. But what do you want to watch football for? Is it to see the best, or is it to support your team? And is it to travel home and away supporting your team? For a lot of fans, a lot of the new generation, a lot of the esports fans, they just want to see the best. They want to see the Ronaldos, the Messis. I'm not going to put Richarlison in that, but De Bruyne's. And for me, that's why I love Watford getting relegated, because you get tired of getting smashed 7-8, 9-1 or 6-0 in the FA Cup final. I love Watford going to Wycombe Wanderers next week. I love the fact that we've got a derby against Luton Town. You know what? Fucking let them go. If United, City, Liverpool, if those clubs want to play in the European League, let them have it. I would much rather watch Millwall Watford on a rainy Tuesday night at the Den with a packed house and music blazing. And I don't think it's just an ownership model issue. I don't think it's just about those two individuals, those two shithouses at the top of their club, wanting to kind of rule the roost. Because we also know that John Berylson is American, and he's willing to well, what's he done this week? He's pledged $300,000 to the Millwall Community Trust. It's not just a money thing. It's the type of personalities we're getting in the game. And unfortunately, EFL and Premier League aren't doing enough to support the game and who's running it at the moment.
I just wanted to make the point. Everything that you both have said is correct. But there's a reason why this has come to pass right here, right now. And that's the impending financial catastrophe produced produced by mismanagement in many cases over time, but also more pertinently by the COVID situation and the fact that fans are not allowed to go to watch football at all at the moment, other than the most lowest levels. So we have an impending financial disaster. Now, I agree that the likes of the Glazers and John Henry and the others, I dare say, do support it. They just have gotten, you know, they've managed to take cover whilst the Liverpool and Manchester United have led the way on this. I can't believe that Arsenal, Chelsea, Spurs aren't thinking, oh, this will be great if it happened and our name is not attached to it. That would be the best outcome of all. But the reason that we're here right now is that we have a financial disaster, and it's literally weeks away. I mean, I posted a piece in the Standard last night from Orient saying they're 5 to 6 weeks away from folding. Scunthorpe by Herds.
So that's not that Orient folding. That's not Orient folding. That was the owner, Nigel Travis, saying he spoke to Mark Chapman on Five Live the other day. He said that clubs will either go out of business in 5 or 6 weeks, or he says after January you'll see a lot of clubs going into admin.
You know, we're lucky at the Den. I don't know what for the situation, Oscar, but I know at the Den we are lucky to have a beneficial owner in John Berylson. We've said it before, and I think we'll say it again now, because we are very lucky in that way that he has an evident love of the club. I can't think why else he would put money in if it was not for those kinds of emotional reasons. Clearly, what's motivating this from the top end, from the Glazer and Henry perspective, is a greed-driven thing, and that's there's no way you can dress this up in any other clothes. But just to go back to an earlier point that Oscar made, when you look at the whole picture, and I've got a screenshot of all of the main elements here. If you take away the biggest thing of all, which is the grab for power, I take just park that to one side for a moment. It's actually a settlement in football that is not a million miles from one that most fans would say, yes, that's a good settlement. You know, the idea of spreading 25% of the Premier League's TV money across the lower divisions, Championship and Leagues 1-2. But there's a lot in there that is worthy of not being lost in the very hostile reaction that is generated. And I think partly that's because it is Liverpool, it is Manchester United, two great names in the game, but also two great names that people like to throw wet sponges at because of their status within the sport. So I think there's a lot in it that we don't want to lose.
Lose the parachute payments, like as in like they've put
parachute payments, yes,
as a Watford fan, don't want to be losing that sort of money. So, you know, let's keep the parachute payments, and that's right. But I do want to add that the Culture Secretary Oliver Dowden has just come out that He has received assurances from the EFL that no EFL club would be allowed to go into administration. Not really sure where the money will be coming from all that. But, you know, politics is politics.
Achtung, Mehlball. I'll tell you what, interesting, there's a lot of shit coming out about Rick Parry now.
A lot of very personal stuff going on about
him. Former Liverpool CEO, and a lot of people saying that Rick Parry sort of formed this whole idea. He formed this idea, and he wanted he put it to Liverpool, Manchester United, put it to Liverpool first, and then pushed it towards United. A lot of people calling for him to be booted.
We're going into conspiracies already. This was early.
I can't believe the Football League, EFL, I struggle with that name, but they call it the EFL Football League. I can't believe they didn't appoint Rick Parry without some idea that he's got these kinds of connections to the very, very top. The two biggest clubs in the game, in my opinion, he doesn't have links, certainly to Liverpool. Clearly, there's a lot of, despite being rivals, there's a lot of linkage between the two clubs locally in terms of who knows who. So that's why, if they didn't want what he's brought to the table here, the EFL, then why would they appoint Rick Parry? This is what he's here for, in my opinion, is to produce a deal that's big, that cuts to the chase. Because, as we've said a few times, a lot in this big picture deal is what we would have wanted. The parachute payments, Oscar's mentioned. The idea that you're spreading TV money down to the very bottom. There's support for the women's game. There's support for good causes or whatever they might be. But certainly there's a lot of good stuff in here. It's the naked mafioso grab for power that's the thing. And clearly these two clubs are not going to offer £250 million without being on the winning end of that deal, and that's the sticking point here, isn't it?
I think Aaron was into something in terms of that mafia style dealing permeating this whole project from the way it was communicated to the proposals themselves. When you have Laura Scott, and I'm going to name drop her as a journalist because I thought this was reported terribly, saying and quoting chairman from Burton Albion, Leighton Orient, Preston, saying there was unanimous support. There were no dissenting voices. 23 of 24 clubs were supportive. And then you have a weird situation where you've got chairman and owners going onto Twitter saying that's bollocks. What are you on about? And I thought that was absolutely disgraceful from a BBC journalist to just quote these individuals without doing the work. And it then puts pressure on other people saying, oh, should I be supporting this? And suddenly you're altering the narrative and being manipulative. Didn't like that at all.
I'm guessing desperation's dry. I mean, I dare say, Oscar, there's a lot of, with your fingers crossed behind your back, a lot of acceptance of the situation, of the reality of it, especially if the bank balance is likely to run out in 5 to 6 weeks' time and there's no sight or no other deal on the table. Now, it may be that this has been what they call in the modern political parlance, a dead cat strategy. You throw a dead cat onto the table and everyone jumps. And maybe this is what this has achieved now, because it seems that now there is movement. Suddenly, the Premier League is starting to have conversations that maybe they wouldn't have had, even a few weeks ago. We were hearing how Sainsbury's doesn't help the corner shop.
Fuck this. A drowning man will grab onto any life.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Now, let me tell you something. No one expected COVID. No one expected COVID. And if someone's going to come and turn around and go, oh, the clubs are insured to the hill, this is considered an act of God, which actually in insurance terms is written out as basically we don't pay out.
Force majeure, what they call it. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. When you look at these people who own clubs, they don't want to fork any more money out because they don't have the hundreds of millions. Well, some of them do. They just don't want to put it in. But, they don't have the money to put in. So when they see £250 million bailout, yeah, we'll fucking take that. That's free money. It's free money. But I want to pick up on something that Ian Holloway has said. That's the EFL. This is what Ian Holloway said on TalkSport today. Very, very good. And I know, obviously, he's not very liked on this pod. But you know, he kind of tells it as it is. He said, basically, they've got a gun to all our heads and are trying to take over football and make sure they will get richer. That's not what football's about. It's embarrassing. I've never seen anything quite like it in my life. It's horrendous. It's a time when everyone is struggling the most. They've come up with this. How are the top six? How are they the top six when Manchester United are 16th? Do you know what? That's fucking salient, if I've ever heard it. It's right. They've put a gun to League One and League Two's head and said, well, take it or die.
It's
a shambles. It's absolute shambles. You know, Kieran Maguire was very, very good. Everyone knows him sort of from the Price of Football pod and Price of Football on Twitter. And he just very simply said, for anybody that's got any attachment to football romance who believes in Wigan Athletic winning the FA Cup, this is the final nail in the coffin to prevent such behaviour. I won't quite go with Wigan Athletic because I don't quite like Dave Whelan because he broke his leg in cup final. But, you know, It's what it's about, the romance of football, the sort of sanctity of marriage. This is what it's about. You know what? This is like, you know, a really, really hot woman coming along and going, go on, give me another time. And do you know what my Uncle Sonny said? Because this is what happened to my Uncle Sonny. My Uncle Sonny, for anyone who knows him, lovely man, the falafel king. He owned a couple of chip shops in the West End, yeah? And
we've got to hear it now. Come on, we've got to hear the story.
Married with two kids, couple of fish and chip shops in the West End. Lovely guy, you know, proper cheerful guy. And this Polish lady working for him, and he got thought, oh yeah, I'll have a bit of that. And he started. What's the word?
Frying tonight.
Come on, Nick. Try a good work on the pun, mate. Fornicating with her. Let's just say that.
Battering the fish.
Battering the fish, you name it. And his wife found out and he got divorced. He thought, yeah, this is great. Look, she's so fit, blah, blah. You know, she's great and whatnot. Trust me, you ask him now, he will not say the same thing. All he ever says to me is, son, the grass is never greener on the other side. That's because she moved in her mother-in-law, who speaks no English, from Poland to watch him and everything he does. Yeah, literally, you sit in his house all years. Honey, that's it. That's his wife. Your whole
fuck. I tell you what, Oscar. Next podcast, we got to get Uncle Sonny on this show.
Uncle Sonny is the biggest legend.
You can take him on Jeremy Carr. Is that still there?
Nah, man, he's too nice, Jeremy Carr. And do you know, like he always says to me, the grass is never greener on the other side. This is like that situation. Premier League, don't be that Polish woman in the chip shop, yeah? Don't do it. Don't do it. We don't need you. The Football League will continue. Trust me. It will roll on. It will absolutely roll on. Club needs to get over the next hurdle of the next 2 months. The country needs to get over the hurdle of the next 1 to 2 months. And I think things will slowly get better, you know?
Well, this brings us on to Oscar's specialty, which is one of the things. I mean, obviously, the gun to our head at the moment is the fact that the COVID restrictions mean that professional football can't have crowds. And then this week there's been all sorts of hoo and ha online as the London Palladium seems to have sold a show where there didn't seem to be an awful lot of social distancing going on, and you know, looked like a pretty packed auditorium. And the contrast between you know, the fact that theatre seems to be able to have paying customers and football, which would help sustain the clubs rather than having to, you know, meet the devil at the crossroads and sell your soul. Maybe football could survive. But Oscar, we messaged on Twitter and you said it's not quite as simple as that. Is it that there's more to it than just that straight contrast between theatre and the arts and major sport?
Yeah, I wish it was that simple. I wish it was just someone turning up to the theatre and sitting there watching a game of football. So the difference between what we're dealing with in football and fans not being allowed to go, or at least being allowed to go outside of the elite levels, apparently that's the top six of the football hierarchy, and someone going to the theatre, is you need to separate the two instantly, because football is cursed not so much by reputation, but by demographic and infrastructure. Now, I'll try and explain this as easily as I can, but both of you feel free to kind of interrupt me and ask questions.
Are we speaking of economic class here?
we're going to touch on it. We're definitely going to touch on it. But yeah, you both brought it up earlier. It's okay. A working class game. And that means that there are different social mixing patterns or networks between those that attend the theatre, and I am going to do a bit of stereotyping here,
yep.
and those that go to the football. So if you're in a high contact job, by that I mean you are interacting with lots of people every day, instantly you're higher risk than someone who is able or financially capable of doing a job where they can work from home. So instantly your social mixing patterns are different. You also factor in things like travel and social aspects of what you get up to at the weekend or in your spare time. So football fans are highly mobile as a population. They also use public transport, and they're also impacted by traveling across the country. So there is significant regional variance at the moment in prevalence and incident rates. By that, I mean there are higher infections in the northwest and northeast than there are in the southwest and southeast. With football, you would have those football fans traveling between those areas weekly, if not every couple of days. So you'd be impacting significantly on the transmission rates across the country.
Okay.
You then have the experience of going to a football fan and the compliance rates of the football population. Unfortunately, this is where the curse of reputation comes in, whereby football fans are deemed a little bit less likely to social distance, to comply with face coverings and social.
And more likely to get pissed and things
exactly.
like
that. Exactly. There you go. You said what I wasn't willing to say. But we saw it with Liverpool winning the league. We saw it with Leeds getting promoted. Yeah. Now, we know that won't be the whole prison pyramid. But unfortunately, when it's so visible and it's happening so regularly with people travelling up and down the country every week via public transport, it is a significant issue. So I don't think that has been factored into the considerations, but what people have been looking at is infrastructure. Hang on a minute, why can I watch football indoors and hear Arsene Wenger talk at the Palladium with another 500 people, but I can't go down to the Den or the Emirates or Old Trafford, social distancing with a couple of thousand people. Again, football isn't as simple as an indoor-outdoor sport. So you've got to think, how are you getting there? Who are you interacting with? You're going through turnstiles. You're having high contact with people. You're using hospitality facilities and lavatory facilities. Yeah, you're queuing for things if food and alcohol are being served. If they're not, you're then still having regular contact with people at half time, and you are moving around your seats. We wish it was that easy that people would sit there like they do at the Palladium. You come in, you come out, you're done, and that will be happening as a one-off. You've then got the impact on public services. So football isn't just 22 people turning up on a pitch with a few fans watching. You've got the police, you've got first aid, you've got paramedics, you've got the implications on NHS capacity and absences of unfortunately, on Saturdays is when A&E feels the effects most from people interacting at the weekend. Football would be a further burden on that, not only taking staff away from their frontline duties, but also more people requiring to use them. You've also got to be thinking of the behaviours at a venue. At the Palladium, there might have been a Tottenham fan or a Chelsea fan abusing Arsene Wenger from the sidelines, calling him a wanker. But in reality, you're sitting there quietly. You're potentially keeping your mask on. But at the football, you're shouting, you're singing, you're talking loudly. Droplets, aerosol transmission.
You're often in a rebellious state of mind, if that's not an odd way to put it, because walls are often there to be broken in the stadium, aren't they? You know, it's part and parcel of the crowd mentality.
Exactly. And then we haven't even got into the issues of testing. So I know Millwall's pictures have been doing the rounds and how much work Billy and co have been doing at the club to make sure there is a safe environment. But ultimately, how successful can fever checks and heat checks and those things be when actually you can have false negatives with tests, you can have different symptoms, you have people not showing symptoms. I think with fevers and temperatures at the moment, it's around 50-50 how many people present. So you're going to have 50% walking through the turnstiles anyway, potentially being asymptomatic or pre-symptomatic, i.e. not showing symptoms, but still being infectious. The best thing we could look at is loss of taste or smell. Maybe get someone to, you know, have cheese and onion crisps.
I'm handicapped at the Den, Oscar.
But so you can see it's not as easy as just turning up at a theatre and watching a game of football.
the prospects of this, I mean, there's a petition that's been online a lot, 195,000 signatures when I checked the other day. It may well be more now, maybe over the 200 mark. Pressure on Oliver Dowden, the Secretary for Culture and Sport. Highly unlikely, in your opinion, that that's going to change for the reasons that you described, because clearly with restrictions being ever tighter in England and Wales and, you know, in the other countries too, it's to allow football fans back in would fly in the face of that general theme, wouldn't it?
It's too late. Yeah. The time to open up and get fans into the grounds has now passed. We're on kind of lockdown now through to the end of the second wave, April, May time. So yeah, there is going to be no capacity for fans to return anytime soon. I think Millwall have acted quickly to at least do a beam back at the weekend at the Den. I think that's smart to get a little bit of income. I mean, there's questions about whether we should be interacting in such groups anyway, but where you're legally allowed to exploit it and take that opportunity to create money, but that won't be lasting long. And we're only going downhill from here.
So no fans, rightly or wrongly, no Project Big Picture money, no 250 million. Something has to give here soon, doesn't it? Because, you know, we've touched on it already. We don't want to go over the whole debate over the rights and wrongs of the big picture. But one thing it did do was deliver a bailout fund on the 250 million scale that, that Rick Parry and the EFL say is going to be the lost income for the season.
Just on Rick Parry again, Nick. This is also the man who pushed to the Premier League.
No, he was an architect of it.
He was quite the head honcho within the campaign to actually form the Premier League. He'll be back. Don't worry about that. They'll be back and they'll be trying to push something else soon enough. They've got something between their teeth and they're going to try.
Absolutely. I mean, the formation of the Premier League, I'm old enough to remember it. You know, in the late 80s, there's this constant thing. Initially, it was when live TV started to cover, you know, league football on a Sunday afternoon. And that was the start of the new world, in a sense, because previously it was just been recorded highlights. But gradually, as the potential of live television dawned on the club owners, you started to get the push towards the Premier League. So from our brief period at the top in 88 to 1990, that was the kind of lead into this period. And you had to throw into the mix the need to rebuild stadiums after the hooliganism problems of the mid-80s. So, you know, the logic of that was established then, which is that bigger clubs carry bigger names, that people in downtown Bali don't want to watch Burnley play Palace. They want to watch Liverpool play, you know, Manchester United or the other big names of Europe. That's what they want to watch. And I think there's a certain hard truth to that. You know, how many times on Super Sunday have you thought, oh God, it's Wolves versus Sheffield United. I think I'll pass on that. There is a hierarchy of pulling power. For want back to the chip shop and your uncle again, pulling power. and these clubs at the top want their worth, and that may not include the likes of the lesser breeds in the Premier League. I think this might have been an eye-opening experience for the Fulhams and for the others, you know, that suddenly you're not on the inside of this gang. But this is a logical, and the European Super League is the logical conclusion. Everything you've seen in the Champions League, I still can't shake calling it the European Cup, because that's the pristine competition of my youth.
And exactly,
the Champions League, and it's ever expanding fixtures that you don't care about.
But what made it such a pull for you? What made it so enticing to watch?
What, football generally, or for
the European Cup?
Well, it's the great games. I mean, you know, my earliest first football memory for me was George Best winning the European Cup with Manchester United at Wembley. I can remember that because we watched it on TV, black and white TV. And then you go into the 70s and you've got Johan Cruyff and Ajax and Liverpool's exploits and Nottingham Forest and so on and so forth. All of the big names of football, and you followed it.
But you knew they were the best the nation at the time.
Every team that took part in the European Cup was a champion of their country, and that was
that's kind of the point of the Champions League. If you look at it, you know, now obviously it's like, you know, the fourth person who qualifies, you know, you go all the way to like Yugoslavia and play someone twice home and away, and you know, you qualify that way and stuff like that. Again, the Champions League has been open.
But that ship sailed donkey's years ago.
No, the UEFA bods have properly opened it up and turned it into something. The European Super League, however, it stinks. It fucking stinks. Because it's about you turning round to your base model, and I don't want to say clientele, your base effectively, and saying, yeah, we've outgrown you, see you later now. It's like a club turning around to the Football League, the Premier League, and going, yeah, see you later, pal. Forget it. We've done 100 years. Yeah, we're going to go and you're going to do something else.
It relates to the pumping up of the World Cup into ever more teams taking part in it. It's desire to feed the TV monster.
It dilutes the product, doesn't it? It kind of destroys the reason we want to watch those events.
Absolutely.
Because they're a one-off, they're a rarity. And they feel special. And you want to know that the teams there are the best teams. But then you also want to kind of be able to say, oh, yeah, you know, I've seen that. I'm connected to that. My team contributed to that team winning the league. And I'm one of those old school people that when my dad and I watched European football, we were always meant to support the English team. I know that's getting a little bit and people don't care as much, and you see the abuse on social media and the glee when Arsenal fans get to watch Tottenham lose to Liverpool in the Champions League final, and that has gone a little bit, and you can see what's driving these views that a European Cup or European League is how you're going to kind of maintain interest in it.
And one of the
definitely needs to do something different.
One of the hooks of the interrupting Oscar just on European and football and TV. But one of the hooks that was selling the Project Big Picture, which, as I've said a couple of times, I don't believe has completely gone away, but was the Football League was going to subcontract its TV negotiations over to the Premier League. So the Premier League was going to take the product being English football, including Championship football, and I guess League One, Two, I suppose, and they were going to sell as a complete package to markets around the world. And the EFL were going to do that because the Premier League is such a past master at extracting maximum value that they were going to make money by that method. So, you know, I know that as we're recording this, the big picture has been shot down in flames, but I don't believe it's gone away, and I don't believe the likes of the Super League, whether you like it or not, that won't have gone away either. That will all come back again. Another day. In what form, we don't know. We wait to see. I mean, I'll put it to you two chaps. You, Aaron, you're a Premier League club fan, and Oscar Watford, not so long out of the Premier League.
I'm not a fan, I'm a supporter.
All right.
Comparison to these franchise bastards that sit and order a fucking shirt every year, I plow $1,500 into my club every year. Doesn't matter if I don't go or not. I plow £1,500 of season tickets every year. You know,
but the threat from the Glazers and John Henry is
at the end of the day, right, Nick? Right now, honestly, right now, I'm at a point where if we end up in a European Super League, I'm done. I will walk away from my football club. And do you know what? I'd rather go and support a club that actually fucking deserves my money. And you know, people always turn around to me and they go, oh, you know, you have this little loving with Wimbledon. The reason I have a loving with Wimbledon is because they deserve my money. They actually fucking deserve it. They fought against
this corporatization and whatever you want
to say. Yeah, against football globalization, against franchising. People turn around to me and go, oh, you're going to jack your team and you're going to be a glory hunter. Mate, it ain't about the fucking glory. It ain't about the fucking glory. It's about the fact that you've got a club, you've got a team, and do you know what? You're actually proud of them. You actually get excited about them. You're not sat there thinking to yourself, oh, what are these bastards going to pull out next? What stunt is it next? It's like now this pay-per-view deal, this £15 deal. I'm sat here going, like, fuck am I paying £15? I will not pay £15. I'd rather listen to it on the radio and watch it an hour later on Match of the Day. No, it's not going to happen. It's just about greed. It's just about money. With Manchester United now, you know, like your season ticket and stuff, they don't care if we don't renew. They don't give a shit because people will go and snap the tickets up. They'll go and buy them. And I love my club. And genuinely, the most depressing thing is when I'm at Media City and I look out across the office and you see across the fucking the keys and you see Old Trafford there, and it's depressing. It's so depressing because I love my club so much. And you know what? I'm so lucky. I've been to 1, 2, 3, 4 European Cup finals with my club, 4 Champions League finals with my club, countless FA Cup finals, countless League Cup finals. I've seen us lift trophies. I'm so lucky. But right now, I feel so detached from my football club. It's unreal. I refuse to buy a shirt anymore. I will not buy a shirt anymore. Now, the sad thing is if I let go of my season ticket, I lose my points history effectively. Like, you know, I mean,
lose your place in the
I lose my place. You've got 27, 28 years, 30. No, fucking hell. It's 30 years now. 30 years of points histories, of away games, of Europeans. Mate, I've been to Lille away, PSG away, Real Madrid away, Barcelona away, Bayern Munich away. I've been to all these places, Wolfsburg away, Michael Owen's gone a fucking hat trick. I've been home and away. I've been to Russia with Manchester United. If I bin off my season ticket, I'm done. I've no place. And then I become even bigger.
Aaron, at least you won't have to watch Man United lose in all those places anymore.
But there you go, man. Do you know what? I enjoy it. I enjoy watching football. You know, I enjoy people turn around to me and, you know, this job I do, I go and watch random clubs every, you know, I fucking love it. I enjoy the basic element of going to fucking Kenilworth Road. Kenilworth Road, Luton. Anyone who knows it, I love going there. Do you know why? Because I respect the fact that Luton have a budget. Luton have a specific budget. But what they've decided to do is instead of going and get the best players, they'll go and get the best recruiter of players in Mick Harford. And they'll do unbelievable recruitment and they'll play good football. You know what? I respect that. I really like that. I love the rawness of it. And that's why I love Wimbledon, because I look at it and I think to myself, you know what? These guys are skinter than skin. They don't have a backer. All they have is the fans' donations. The fans have put £11 million into building the ground. You know, what they've achieved is unparalleled. But do you know what? It's because of the love of football. That's what it is. And I get taken the piss out of by Mark Chapman on Five Live every weekend. He calls me a romantic. And the truth of the matter is, I'm a proper football romantic. I love football and I love the fans and I love what they bring to this game. And I can't bear to see it bastardised anymore. And the sad thing is, it's my club who are doing it.
Probably a good point to close. I just wanted to ask, before we close, I just wanted to ask you, Oscar, the experience of being in the Premier League. You were there quite recently with Watford. You are a Watford fan. I think we've established that already. Did it change the club? Do you come down a different club to the one that was promoted? Did that happen years ago? I think you've been in the Premier League before.
Yeah, no, I think Watford lost their identity in the Premier League, and I think that was both a cause and effect of being in the Premier League. And I got to say that, Aaron, I really like you, but you're making me fall out of love with you because you mentioned Ian Holloway and Luton Town in a single pod. Plus, you
Oscar, I used to watch Watford when they were skin. In the days of Sean Dyche, I used to go and watch Watford. I've sat in the Rouse and, you know, I used to actually live up that way. So literally, if United weren't playing on a Saturday, you know what? For me, 3 o'clock on a Saturday, I have to go and watch football. I don't care what it is. I go and watch Watford under Dyche and go and watch Watford under Malky Mackay in the real crap era. You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, you suffered with me, mate.
I've been there when you've seen people like Don Cowie in midfield and Scott Severin and playing
long ball football with Neil Cox in the middle. That's changed.
Show's turned into a Watford support group this
now. No, but I genuinely miss those days, and Millwall fans will get what I'm talking about, because when you walk down to the Den, you're excited because you never really know what you're going to see, whether you're going to see a good performance or bad performance, but ultimately you don't have much expectation. What Watford did was start to kind of become a little bit glossy, a little bit fancy, and they did up the stadium. Great, we had a shithole in the East Stand, and we had 3 stands for bloody ages. But it got to a point where we lost what we were as a team and our connection to the community. We were buying incredible players like Delafeu, Kapu, and selling crazy money in terms of Ighalo and Richarlison. And what that did was create an ego to play for the club. You had players who were there to move on quickly, but were playing for us just because we were in the Premier League. There was no heart, there was no desire, there was no commitment on the pitch. That's why we still love gritty players like Will Hughes. We still love Ben Foster, because they want to be there. They're actual Watford players, and they put that on their Twitter profile, and they're sing and shout it from the rooftops. But that's lost. And what has been done really well with Gary Rowett and the Millwall side is that they've got an identity. They know who they are. They've got a core group of players who are gritty, who are feisty, but play quality football. And that's what I miss. And that's why I'm quite glad that Watford have got relegated, because they can find that identity again. They can find themselves and who they want to be and what type of club they want to be. And they can reconnect with their fans and hopefully come back stronger.
That's great stuff.
Just on a sort of a massive sort of just like a side point to that, is there any club out there that hasn't lost its identity with success? I mean, obviously with you know, going into the Premier League, I look at certain clubs, and you know, if you can talk to me about clubs over the past 25 years that have come to the Premier League, I can give you a facet of their identity. I think of Swansea City. Swansea City came into the Premier League playing this really great brand of football. They absolutely outscored teams, and they did everything on a budget. They did it really well. But when they came into the Premier League, they overachieved. They finished well one season. They played good football. And then slowly, it started going downhill. When they're paying £20 million from an average player just to try and stay in the Premier League, that's when it goes downhill. And what happens? You get financial ruin, and ultimately you sit languishing in the EFL and you have to rebuild. Cardiff City, when they came up, didn't learn their lesson. Fulham didn't learn their lesson. QPR didn't learn their lesson. All these clubs come up, they lose their identity, they stop playing the brand of football that they came into the division playing, and they fuck up. The only club, truthfully, there's very few. I'd say Blackpool under, I'm sorry again, Ian Holloway, he retained his identity, because at the end of the day, it was a free hit. And the Oystons were there to pocket the money. Blackpool, Cardiff under Warnock, I think they did very well, and they were very, very unlucky as well. Maybe you could say Reading under Steve Coppell. Back in 2005, they won the championship at Accanter, 106 points, a record points tally. They played brilliant football. They had a great squad, a very settled squad. The next season, second season syndrome hits. Ipswich under George Burley in the early 2000s, absolutely brilliant football with McGrill and Magilton, Fabian Wilnis, players like that, Peralta, you know, and they did very, very well. And again, lose their identity, fucking get relegated. Sheffield United this year, watch, mark my words, Sheffield United will struggle this year because they've got an identity, but they haven't got a plan B. I can see them going down. And it's just a reoccurring sort of nightmare for clubs, you know, who just bastardise themselves. They'll try and defend and try and limit damage, if you like, to ensure they stay in this juggernaut that is the Premier League.
Probably a good point to close part one. Did you want to say anything else, Oscar, before we close? Have you said what you wanted to say on this, mate?
Yeah, just it's been a pleasure. Really enjoyed it and glad
Thank
to be
you, mate. Great to, great
Lovely to
you.
Have you. We'll do this again at some point. Oscar, been good, mate, because I've enjoyed it too.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight. and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Achtung, Mehlball.
Welcome, dear listeners. Welcome to part two of this special edition of Achtung Mehlball. Joining me is our show regular, Mr. Ryan Loftus. Thanks for coming on the show, Ryan.
Not a problem, Nick. Thanks for staying up so late for me. You know, I've rushed back from the office. Got the food in the oven. I've got a waiting girlfriend who's, getting ever hungry. But thanks for staying up so late for me so we can have this chat.
Well, we only do it for the most important of subjects. We touched on Project Big Picture, which seems to have been shot down in flames going by the social media tonight, Ryan. I can't help but think it's been shot down in flames, or has it? Because I wanted to get your take on the scheme itself or the plan itself, but also on the tactics involved here. Because I can't believe that Rick Parry, the Glazers, and John W. Henry would have expected to have announced this scheme to a happy reception in the rest of the Premier League. They must have expected it to be voted down. So my thought is, what's next in the game of chess? Because I can't expect, they can't have anticipated this moment.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, the reaction over the last couple of days. I mean, I've been, you know, waiting to have a big rant about it because it's been, you know, on my mind a lot. I've been listening to a lot and reading a lot about it and getting quite pissed off, to be honest, about a lot of people's kind of reception of it. Obviously, it's generally negative, but a lot of people kind of trying to pick out some good from it. Whereas for me, it is entirely negative, whatever way you want to look at it. I think you have to bear in mind, you know, it was leaked. Yeah. I think they had no intention of releasing it now. Whether or not you can't really say that for definite, but you know, the current kind of financial climate makes it a good point maybe to
get release it. But yeah,
you know, they've been working on this for years. It seems 3 years. I think this is the 18th edition of this plan. So it is something that they've had, you know, in the offing, and that will not, it won't go away, even though being shot down or, you know, being met with a mass displeasure or whatever, it won't, this won't go away. This is a precursor, I think, of what is to come and how American owners of football clubs and, you know, the big six want to shape their football. And, you know, Rick Parry is easy to forget that he used to be he was the first chair of the Premier League. He was, you know, involved with Liverpool, and he took over the EFL, really, it may seem, to kind of get this done, is how it's looking at the moment.
I mean, I put myself in the category you just described. I think I've tried to look for the upside of it. Whilst parking the massive elephant in the room, to an extent it's contradictory, and I'm well aware that as I said earlier on, you're selling your soul to the devil at the crossroads, really, aren't you, in this deal? But if we park that transaction with Beelzebub, there are a lot of good parts in the deal. There's a lot in this big picture that you would have wanted to have designed if you'd been given the blank sheet of paper, Ryan. Or would you not agree with that? Are you seeing nothing good in the elements?
No, I wouldn't agree at all. I think the bits that seem good, I think, are, it's a kind of an unmasked way of effectively, here is the price we're putting on English football. This is what we're going to let us buy it, effectively, yeah. For me. It's the money that they are offering to the Football League to save it. They're doing that because it's on its knees as it is. And I think it's a really cynical thing that, I mean, despite my years, I'm a very cynical person generally. And
believe that, Ryan.
I'm very despairing of football in general. I know it's, you know, I think I've got there early, but, you know, in a world like it is today, I think it's far easier to be cynical sometimes.
Listeners, he's fresh-faced, but he's got a weary soul.
Exactly. It's been worn down by many years, and I think 2020 isn't really helping. But
No.
I think generally, what... I think you have to, okay, the game is at a point where it is in financial ruin.
Yes.
You know, to not put it lightly, because of COVID, but without COVID, it is, again, the game is clearly becoming unsustainable. But you have to look back and ask, why is the game becoming unsustainable? Why are clubs, especially in the Championship, but in League One now as well, it's spreading, why are they spending so much money? Why are they overspending so much money? And the reason for that is because of the Premier League. There's no question. Because of the trickle-down money, because the Premier League was set up to stop any money going outside of the Premier League. And that's what it's done. It's dried up everything else so that no teams can really, you know, survive on their own. They've got EPPP to take the best young players for a pittance. So, you know, one avenue that of finance that people had, you know, for, outside the Premier League, was selling on big young players or, you know, developing their own players. But the Premier League has put a stop to that in order to give them 2% more of their massive billions of TV deals. So the only reason this money chasm and this dearth of money and this whole problem is because of the Premier League. So the Premier League are paying for a problem that they caused, that they knew they would cause, which they wanted to cause. So for me, the game today is obsessed with money. Sky Sports, the papers, the owners, so many of the fans are obsessed with money.
Yeah, I agree.
Transfers, you know, how much, who's the owner? How much is he worth? You look at the Newcastle fans losing their minds over potentially becoming a super rich club, but ignoring all the facts of who was actually trying to take them over. Yeah. You know, the game is obsessed with money, and that is fundamentally wrong. That is not why I like football. That is not why I would say 90% of match-going fans. Forget all the fans who sit and watch games on their sofa. The game isn't for them. I know that's the industry as it's going, but the game isn't for them. The money that is in the game is driven it to such a point that it's on its knees, where I'm at a point, given everything else that is in this deal, let the EFL crumble if it has to without accepting this deal and rebuild it. Right. Would be my stance, right. Because the clubs, you can say, look, the clubs have got themselves into this situation, or, you know, greedy owners or overspending, whatever. The game needs to learn to be sustainable. And if this is a harsh wake-up call to teach it that, then let it learn its lesson. Don't sell away all of your rights. Because what this deal does, by handing power to an elite six clubs, it kind of just ruins all integrity of what football is, and what the whole point, you know, teams in League One aspiring to rise up the leagues, or even, you know, the lower sites in the Premiership does it not
formalize reality, Ryan? Because you're right. I wouldn't dispute anything that you said. I didn't dispute anything the chap said in part one of the show, which is of a similar vein, you know, without being specific, it's similar to what you're saying now. But is this the scheme as cooked up? And I think that's probably a good phrase, because it's been done in secret and it was announced as a kind of like a nuclear bomb. I saw it described on one column prior to a meeting that was scheduled to discuss the impact of COVID and the shutdown and the crisis that's causing. Does this scheme not formalise the practical reality? I mean, whether we like it or not, Liverpool, Manchester United, Chelsea and Arsenal and Spurs, maybe one or two others, are amongst the biggest clubs on the planet. They occupy this kind of gilded spot in world sport. Now, we might not like it. We follow a club that is never going to get to that level, has no desire to be at that level. But equally, we have our position within the pyramid. The scheme does seek to spread some of the money around to a greater level than is going on right now. That was what I picked out as being amongst the better part. There are other bits and pieces, and some you can say, yeah, tick or cross, whatever way you want to look at it. But at its heart, is it not accepting the reality that there is an elite group of clubs that operate in a stratosphere way beyond our dreams, a European stratosphere, world stratosphere, and then there's the rest of football that wants to survive this winter, certainly, and potentially prosper within a fairer structure? What do you say to that? I take all the bad stuff. I accept it. But there is elements in it that seek to change it.
Change of course, that redistribution, I think, is one of the massive plus points that people have kind of harped on about. And I think, again, the way that sport is covered, football is covered in England and, you know, on most media outlets, it is from basically the top half of the Premier League is what they talk about and everything below it doesn't matter. So the idea that, look, they're giving the lower leagues a bit more money from, they should just be happy and accept it. But what costs a man's soul, really? I think the whole reason of the package as it is now is, okay, they say we give you 25% of our TV revenues. We'll take it all in and redistribute it fair so we can get it better.
Yeah.
Why? What happens then in 5 years' time when the top six go, actually, forget that. Fuck that. Yeah. We're not doing that anymore. We'll give you 5% and we're going to vote it through on our own. And
I've seen that.
And we will do it. And I think that's just not, it's not even not inconceivable. It is, I would say, almost a dead cert to happen. I think that the whole point of doing this now, and, you know, whether it was leaked or whether they kind of slyly put it out there to kind of get this ball rolling, they are doing it now because clubs are on their knees so that in 5 years' time they can go, remember when we saved you? You cannot say anything about this. And, like, you know, the rules of, they can remove the head of the Premier League by voting it through themselves. They can stop other owners taking over to stop it themselves. This just enshrines the Big Six as it is now in a snapshot of, you know, current times. Chelsea were never a big club until Abramovich came in.
Oh, absolutely,
you know,
not.
Spurs
absolutely
were not one of the money bag sides. Man City were never one of the big sides. You know, all these, the clubs that are now defined as the super rich. What happens if Newcastle did want to get taken over? What happens if a billionaire wants to buy Aston Villa or Leeds or anyone and make them one of the big clubs? They can just vote that and say, no, you're not having it. What this does is permanently enshrines the four or five who happen to be in vogue now as the permanent Big Six. And I mean, this is really, I see it as a precursor to them breaking away and, or them at least threatening to break away. And, you know, whether that's a European Super League, their own league, whatever it is, if it gets to that point, they fuck off, like, let them go. If I think what it is, it's the American owners, so Man United and Liverpool, who are driving this, both have American owners who are involved with American football clubs. And they don't understand how they don't get more money because all NFL clubs are profitable businesses because they, you know, in America, people live to make money and they do it well, especially in sport. They can't understand English football, how it runs, how clubs have an equal say in things, how, you know, West Brom, who've just come up this season, get the same say as Man United in a vote in the Premier League. But that's democracy. That is how things are set up. And they don't want that. They want to enshrine it. They want to have no relegation or promotion, I guess, in the long run, and just have these big money bags teams facing each other every season. But that's not what football is about in England, or really in Europe, or, you know, globally.
No, I agree.
And, you know, because of their current situation, because they happen to own these clubs at this time, why should they get the say to dictate how sport should be in England? You know, they're not above our culture and our history. They are just, you know, the Glazers have owned Man United for 5 minutes and now they want to restructure the entire game. And it just doesn't sit right with me in any way.
No, I make you right. I mean, we've touched on American sports models, which, I mean, you look at NFL, Major League Baseball, any of them, the National Hockey League, basketball, they're sealed competitions. You don't, you know, you and me couldn't go to some park in downtown Brooklyn and start a baseball team and expect to make it to the top. Whereas, in theory at least, we could go and start a team in Beckton Park and aim for the very top if we could sustain it long enough. It might be a very unlikely outcome, but the potential, the route exists, isn't it? I mean, for any non-league side, the route is there. And I take the point entirely that it's what I think we've called before the jewel in the crown. It is the essential beauty of English football. the great problem is, yes, you're right, there's a sense of extortion about this deal, which is true. I can't deny that either. But equally, we're staring at casualty rates that are going to be very, very high if no money's forthcoming. I accept all the criticisms of the deal. My problem, I think, in a nutshell, is not the criticisms of the deal, because I can see what you can see and everyone else has pointed out. I don't see another deal around. Now, it may come to pass now that the Premier League have had their cages rattled by this experience, possibly. The government are leaning on them, but I don't put much faith in this government to do anything that's going to be of any practical use. Sorry if anyone out there voted for them, and you know, I don't know. You know, if it turns out that Oliver Dowden is General Custer riding at the head of the US Cavalry, well, I think Custer got shot in the end. So I won't put too much faith in that. Yeah. So I don't see another deal. My point being, where's the money going to come from if not from something that looks like this, Ryan?
Definitely, and that is, I think, one of the biggest problems. And it is a bit of a standoff between Premier League clubs. I think you can lay as much blame for this at the government's door, the lack of support given, the lack of letting fans in. You know, that obviously has been through the last few days of, you know, other places having fans or having fans having spectators inside theatres and places like that. And that has obviously driven up even more resentment that football isn't allowed fans in, where that would go a big way to helping clubs out and, you know, stopping this dire need for money. But that doesn't look like it's forthcoming. So you can lay a lot of the blame, I think, at the current government's door in terms of how they are dealing with football, because I think it's been said by a number of people, you know, sports writers and politicians alike, saying that Boris Johnson and Oliver Dowden, they see the top of the Premier League spending a lot of money, and that for them means football is fine. You know, but I think the people who need helping out the most in football are from League One and down. Personally, I don't think the Championship warrants a bailout in any way. Millwall are struggling, but obviously having fans in would help us. But there are enough teams in the Championship that have mega rich owners and who have been overspending like crazy for years that this is their own fault. We look at teams like Reading, who spend three times their income on wages, Forest, who are massively overstretched. You look at Stoke, who spend 60-70 million in a transfer window, but are owned by one of the richest people in the UK in Bet365's CEO. They've got more than enough money to survive this. But look at teams below the pyramid who really rely on that matchday income. That's where the worry is. And, you know, giving money to them from a government or from the Premier League, whoever it comes from, is going to be massively important from like League One, League Two, National League and further down. But it is a big problem of where it comes from. I think what this has shown, again, this deal, is that the Premier League could easily do it. The Premier League easily has the money to spare because they've literally given everyone forward a proposal saying, we've got this money to spare if you want it. So I think there was a statement today about the EFL was discussing the £50 million that the Premier League are offering. Yeah. And I think the issue here actually is an interest. It's almost not a separate issue, obviously, because it's all linked, but is the attitudes of the smaller Premier League clubs is an interesting one here. So for Manchester United and Liverpool, we put this forward. To be honest, they could easily help out the league if they were, you know, if enough pressure was put on them. I think they wouldn't really struggle with doing that. The ones who here are showing their greediest nature are the Crystal Palaces, the Brightons, the Burnley. So I think
the small fry. I agree.
I think a big comment that has been made about why this big picture has been released is because the Premier League are getting increasingly pissed off with the comments made by Steve Parish about lower league clubs not getting bailed out because other businesses aren't doing it. The comments by Sean Dyche saying the same, small hedge funds don't bail out, or big hedge funds don't bail out small hedge funds, so fighting why should ones. We? But that is to completely miss the point and miss the nature of what football is. Other hedge funds don't rely on other hedge funds to play a game every Saturday. And the Premier League get really pissed off when they say things like that. And the deals that they've been putting forward to the EFL have all had massive stipulations, like a harsh salary cap in the Championship or null and voiding relegation this season. And that is all in self-interest from those smaller clubs to preserve their temporary status as Premier League clubs. And that has pissed off the big clubs. And obviously it's pissed off the EFL clubs. So we're getting to a point, I think this big picture thing is part of it, where it's almost a standoff between the top six, the EF and the EFL on one side, and then the bottom 14 clubs in the Premier League. And it's a very odd place to be, where really all that's happening at the bottom of it is, you know, the likes of Lincoln and Shrewsbury are sitting with a begging bowl with their fingers crossed, hoping that these bigger clubs can sort themselves out.
I mean, something has to give, because you've summarised it brilliantly. A deal has to be struck from somewhere soon. Maybe now this is what will happen as a result of the shock of the new proposals, plans, stitch up, whatever way you want to put it. It's also introduced a lot of the good elements that we've mentioned a few times across the show, and it's put them on the table. So I am intrigued to know what the next move in this chess game is going to be, because I cannot believe that intelligent men like John W. Henry and Joel Glazer and Rick Parry, in fairness to him, I've sat down and thought, well, let's just announce the annihilation of the bottom 14's voting rights, and they'll all, you know, organise a party for us and say thank you very much. They must have known this would be the outcome. So what?
100%. I think this is very much that classic negotiation tactic of, you know, putting the first thing you put out there is massively overstretching. You put everything that you could ever dream of wanting for people to go, are you mad? And then you go, okay, we'll take this off, we'll take this off, we'll take this off. And in the end, you end up with what you really wanted, with a bit less, you know, but pushing back on it, really. I think there will be plenty of stuff in there that the top six, or the, you know, the two or three parties that are putting this forward will happily renege on, or go, oh, do you know what? We'll forget that. We won't do that. But it might also go, you know, 25%. Okay, we'll drop it down to 12 and anything like that. I mean, something has to give. You are right. Something has to give, because we're looking at a situation where football just can't go on. And, you know, like I said, I don't think that the Championship clubs, the majority of them, deserve a bailout. I don't think that, you know, like I said earlier as well, I'd rather see football kind of go to the wall temporarily than give over all the power to a limited few. But something does need to be done, and it is hard to see where it's coming from, and that is the big worry. And, you know, like you say, this could all be stopped really with letting fans in, and or at least temporarily put on pause. This won't be the last we hear of this, or or anything. But I think the end route of this will be, give us what we want, or we will break away from the Premier League and make our own mini tournament or European Super League or whatever it is. I think this is the ball is getting rolling on that. And I think they've got until realistically the end of the next broadcast rights package, or I think it's 2023, to decide what they want. And, you know, we'll see what happens, I think. But the most important thing for me is, like I say, I couldn't care less about the top six, really. I couldn't care less about Premier League compared to, you know, my interest in Millwall or other clubs. But that's where the worrying aspect of it is now. And I want to see football saved or figure out a way to be viable and financially secure in the long run. And I don't want to do that by selling it off, really.
Achtung, Millwall.
That gives us a good segue into Millwall. We have to remember this is a Millwall podcast, listeners, and people tune in to get Millwall news and comment.
Of course.
But we can't ignore the biggest story in football, in English football. So
definitely.
I want to move on to Millwall, if I may, with you, Ryan. Obviously, you've got a game this coming Saturday away at Wycombe Wanderers. A couple of stories I just picked out on the South London Press website. The transfer deadline is still, I think it closes very shortly. Can't remember what date it is. Anyway, we're still able to make moves. There's a story that Gary Rowett is hoping to add to the Millwall squad Friday's transfer deadline. Reputedly, he's looking for a central midfielder, which will bring us to Ben Thompson in a moment. And then potentially another striker, given that Troy Parrott is still crocked. And Ben Thompson, just to, you know, fit in with that story, is itching for a loan exit. He's not getting game time.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. I will feel quite sad to see the back of Ben Thompson, and I know that's some would say it's a little bit sentimental, but it would be a very sad day that Ben Thompson leaves for Portsmouth. Rowett doesn't seem to fancy him at all, Ryan.
Yeah, I think it's a hard one with Ben Thompson because his whole Mill reputation really has been built on his returning from a loan spell at Portsmouth, and obviously, you look back, he didn't get a load of goals, but he definitely had an impetus and kind of uplifted the team. But then also you look back at that season and we survived because other teams were worse than us. You know, we didn't win that many games in the second half of the season and we didn't have a great escape. We just kind of were happy that Rotherham were in the league that season and they always go down.
Yeah.
So he's never been amazing as a Millwall player. He's been the one that's full of promise. And I think the thing is with him is he's probably been our most promising player in a long while. And so, like you say, to see the back of him would be sad. On loan, I don't think it would be too bad because obviously he's still our player. He'll develop a bit more. But whether he's quite at the Championship level, I think what's interesting is as well is Rowett's not the first manager not to back him at this level. Harris sent him out on loan initially.
That's
obviously
true.
He was a little bit younger, but you know, he played most of the League One season, and as soon as we got to the Championship, he couldn't get a game. I think the weaknesses in his game are his kind of positional discipline. Millwall fans love that he gets about the pitch and puts himself about, but when you're trying to play how Rowett wants, where everyone's positionally tight and disciplined, it's hard. And I think especially it's hard where if we were playing a midfield three with a back four, I think Thompson fits in perfectly. But where we play a two, he doesn't quite fit in, and obviously he played a bit on the left before his injury last season, and you know that doesn't suit him at all. But at the moment, it's really struggling to get him in the team, and I think Mill will need to get better as a team before we can use him, really, because or he needs to learn his place to an extent. It sounds harsh, but it's a really difficult one. I can understand why he's not getting game time under Rowett. I can also understand any frustration that he's not getting game time because he's not really had a run. And I think that is one criticism you can level at Rowett, is that he has a fixed 11 pretty much, and it's hard to get into it because, you know, you look like Conor Mahoney, who people want to see do well.
Yeah.
And he can come on in flashes and he'll have one 20-minute spell where he's really good in a game, like say against the Charlton game, and then he'll have another week where he comes off the bench and he's not very good, but he never starts. Rowett never goes, you know what, you had a good 20 minutes, let's give you a start for three games in a row and see how you do. You know, he's not had that at all. But Thompson also hasn't had that. So it's hard to see him getting minutes. And I think that is harsh on him, but also understandable. But there's one criticism you can level at Rowett. And if that pushes him away from the club, I think that'll be a big negative mark on Rowett's kind of a copybook at Millwall.
I agree. I mean, just as an aside, I was just reading the South London Press story that Ben is pushing for a loan exit. I hadn't realised he's 25, Ryan. I mean, that's a critical point in a player's short, you know, footballer is a short one. 25, you really need to be an established position player. You know, if it's not going to happen now, it's not going to happen at all for you. So I can understand Ben's desire for game time. You're right about Harris never really being on fire, you know, for Ben. Rowett clearly has a different format in mind for the midfield, and he's paid to produce the results. And I also agree that this is a big turning point for Gary Rowett. It'd be the first unpopular, controversial stroke decision that he would have taken.
Yeah.
And although the form of the side, I mean, was it one? That was the first defeat, wasn't it, just before the break? It's okay, but not brilliant form at the moment. So Rowett will need to liven things up a little bit if he's going to let one of our much-loved players go, because you need to be up with something in the aftermath of that. Game at Wickham on Saturday, they've had an appalling start. They do look out of their depth in the Championship. My note to myself, I want to get your take on it, is I would be very, it will hurt a lot if we don't come back with 3 points from the M40. And so I know you can never never say never, but this will feel like a game that we've got to go and get the win now. Would you agree with it?
I mean, doesn't this game have Fred Onyedinma, 88th minute, 1-0 to Wickham on the end of a Jason McCarthy?
McCarthy, Christ. after Ainsworth has had a row with Rowett and got him sent off or something. Yeah, I know.
It wouldn't be a more Millwall result. And I think this is not a turning point for Millwall season. I mean, we haven't set the world alight in the start. It's been a steady one. It's been all right. But, you know, we've not been fantastic. We've not been, you know, we've been relatively defensively sound, but then, you know, not great against Swansea. You know, two kind of soft goals to lose that one. So this one, if you don't get the win, I think pressure to an extent starts mounting up on Rowett. And this is the sort of game that we'll lose. This is the sort of game that we'll lose without a shadow of a doubt. We played Huddersfield.
You're cheering me up, no end, Loftus.
No, but I mean, we played Huddersfield last season without a win in nine and drew it. You know, Luton without a win in eight or nine and drew that. But, you know, I think Millwall have come a long way. I think this isn't under Rowett. Rowett's Millwall don't lose these games. You know, Rowett's Millwall go on the road and we do our job and we get 3 points. So if he doesn't do that, I think, you know, there will be a little bit of dissent in the ranks. And if that's, you know, a day after Ben Thompson departs on loan, then he's got to do some quick turnaround. But, you know, I think, like you say, Wickham are out of their depth in the Championship. I think that's quite clear for a lot of people to see. And I think we have the quality to just not breeze past them, but, you know, to get the win.
What's score prediction Saturday, Ryan, for Wickham versus Millwall?
I've got to go, I think, 2-0 to Millwall. I think we're defensively solid enough to keep them out. They're pretty much only a threat from set pieces, which I think we should be more than capable of dealing with. But, yeah, I'll go for a 2-0 and Millwall season kind of get up and running.
Kickstart. I'm going to go Wickham Wanderers 1, Millwall 2. I think we have to get those 3 points there, dear listeners. No Fantasy League or ACCA action this week because of the international break. So it only remains for me to say thank you to Ryan for taking time out of your evening, mate. Thank you very much.
No problem. Always good to... you know, hold the world to rights on an actual Millwall pod.
Why else are we here?
We look at the big problems, you know, that are going on in the world of governance and money, and then we really hone in on Ben Thompson's playing situation. So you get it all here, listeners.
There we are, dear listeners. Thank you for listening to this extra show, like extra long show. And do you want to do bye for now, Ryan?
No, why not? Bye for now.
Thank you for listening to Achtung Millwall. If you enjoyed the show, please head over to Apple Podcasts and leave us a cheeky little review. However, to Achtung Millwall, till next time.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.